Welcome to a new episode of Policy Implications Podcast, where policy meets research. I'm your host, Olga Zadorozhna from Kuzminsky University, where I teach in the research in empirical economics. My guest today is Akash Rao, a PhD student from Harvard University, whose research focuses on political, experimental, and behavioral economics. Today, we will be discussing his recent paper called The Immigrant Next Door, Exposure, Prejudice, and Altruism, which is co-authored with Leonardo Burstyn, Tomas Chanet, and Tariq Hassan. This paper raises a very interesting topic of how decades-long exposure to individuals of a given foreign descent shapes natives' attitudes and behavior toward that group. So welcome, Akash, and let's get started. But before we dive into the discussion of the paper, please tell us more about your research and how did you become interested in the topics of immigration and the immigration-related prejudice?
So a lot of my research looks at minorities and in particular attitudes toward minorities. And so I think one thing that we've seen over the past couple of years, in the United States, in Western Europe, in, India, Myanmar, China, Brazil, all across the world, it seems like there's a growing wave of hostility toward minorities and particularly immigrants. And one kind of puzzling feature of this hostility is that a lot of it seems to be concentrated in areas that have had relatively little exposure to the minorities that they're expressing hostility against. So, maybe the most striking example in Western Europe is Poland, where we see a situation where this is a country that has the highest Islamophobia as measured by various surveys in Western Europe. And yet Muslims constitute around a 10th of a percent of the population. Right. And so similarly, if you look at the United States in, many parts of rural America where you have a lot of Islamophobia with very few Muslims. And so one question you can ask is, are these two things linked? Is it the case that when you have very little exposure toward a particular group, it's easier to develop feelings of hostility? Maybe it's easier to be influenced by media that portrays negative stereotypes about those groups. And so that's what we're interested in this paper. Are the effects of really interacting with these groups on a day-to-day basis, just natural interactions, going to school with members of this group or volunteering at local communities, do these reverse these negative stereotypes and can they promote more friendly interaction between groups?
So that's really interesting. And so your paper consists of several main parts. In the first part, using the US data, you investigate how long-term exposure to people of Arab Muslim ancestry affects the attitudes of the white non-Muslim Americans toward Arab Muslims. So what data did you use here exactly? And what are your main findings there? And also, what are the main channels driving your results?
Right. So we use a couple of different data sets. And I think, there's been a lot of work studying, say, the political effects of exposure to various minority groups. And so, for example, in Europe, with the recent migrant crisis, there's been a lot of work looking at how exposure to migrants affects political outcomes like far right voting. And so I think our work is going to make progress on this literature in a couple of respects. One is that we'll look at the long-term effects. So, these papers looking at the migrant crisis, generally look at outcomes, maybe a few months or a few years after these communities have exposure to these groups. And so you might think that the effects of being exposed to groups over a period of a few months or a few years, those might be very different than the effects of being exposed to a group over a period of decades. And so I think our paper is going to make some progress on that long-term versus short-term aspect. But also I think our paper is able to use a lot of very interesting outcomes and very cool data sets. So the one that we're most excited by is work, is a data set on the implicit association test. And so the IAT is a method developed by social psychologists to assess what they call implicit prejudice against a particular group. And they distinguish this from explicit measures of prejudice. So an explicit measure of prejudice is, if I'm willing to say, I don't like Arab Muslims, I'm willing to say, I feel strongly that Arab Muslims should not be welcome in the country. And so, these explicit measures have some strengths, but one difficulty is that, a lot of people might not be willing to admit that they're prejudiced against a given group. And a lot of people might not even know that they're prejudiced, right? So there's been a lot of emerging work on implicit biases and how these shape decisions. And so we're going to use cross-county data on the IAT. This is using a website set up by the Harvard researchers that developed the IAT back in the 90s. And so over the past two decades, they've collected, you know, hundreds of thousands of observations from all across the country where people come in and take this Arab Muslim IAT to measure their implicit prejudice against Arab Muslims. And what we find is that counties that have for kind of historical accidents, for, you know, quasi-random reasons, these counties that have larger communities of Arab Muslim descent show lower prejudice against Arab Muslims, both as measured by this IAT, so lower implicit prejudice, and then also lower explicit prejudice as measured by questions like how favorable do you feel toward Arab Muslims, or, you know, what are your opinions about Arab Muslims in the country? So that's kind of our work on attitudes. And then we can also look at political outcomes. So what we find is that counties with larger Arab Muslim populations, the white sort of native population is less likely to support the proposed Muslim ban, right? This was Donald Trump's policy restricting immigration from several Muslim majority countries. And then they're also less likely to vote for Trump in general. And so these effects are pretty sizable. And so I think what it reveals is that sort of long-term exposure toward Arab Muslims really shapes not only your political attitudes, but also kind of things that you might consider deeper, right? Your underlying prejudice against this group.
So that's very interesting. And along these lines, how do you take care of the self-selection bias? Because you also described that people were taking these online survey or test to check if they have prejudice themselves, right? So how do you take care of that, that people actually decided themselves to take the test?
Right, that's a great question. And so the short answer is that using the IAT, it's very difficult to make a lot of progress on that. One thing that we can do is we can limit the sample to people who were forced to take the IAT by their university or by their job. And you know, this is increasingly common because a lot of institutions are concerned with these issues of implicit bias. And so they ask as part of training or diversity trainings or things like that, they ask their employees or students to take these tests. And so of course that doesn't eliminate the selection concern entirely, but it does help us make some progress. And so to make sure that these aren't entirely driven by self-selection, we can look at some of the explicit measures from other data sets. So the other data sets that we use are designed to be representative of the US population in a way that these implicit measures are not. And so what we can show is that using these representative measures, the results still hold. It still seems that long-term exposure to Arab Muslims are reducing explicit prejudice and political hostility against these groups.
Oh, that's great. And then you go a step forward and you show that exposure to Arab Muslims increases charitable donations to Arab countries. And I think that's very interesting. And so what data did you use to show that effect? And what mechanisms are responsible for your main results here?
So for this analysis, we worked with two large-scale organizations that channel donations to disaster-struck foreign countries. And so these two organizations were very helpful. They were able to provide us individualized donation data that showed, you know, both the time of donation, the county of residence of the donor, and then also which foreign country they're donating to. And so what we can show is that counties that have these larger populations of Arab Muslims are donating more to Arab Muslim countries in times of disaster. Now, one, you know, thing that is very helpful about this data set is that we can restrict the sample of donors to people who are not themselves of Arab Muslim descent. And so, you know, these organizations provided us with the names of the donors. And so what we're able to do is classify donors based on their names and say, are these people likely of Arab Muslim descent? You know, do they have a name like Muhammad, or do they have a name like Joe Smith, right? And so we can limit the sample to people who are not themselves, or at least who don't have Arab Muslim names, and we can show that these effects are driven by whites, right? By white, say native people seem to be donating more. So it's not just that counties that have larger Arab Muslim populations are donating more to Arab Muslim population, Arab Muslim countries, because the Arab Muslims in those counties are donating. It seems to be really a treatment effect on the white natives.
And so you explain it by saying that because people have more exposure to Arab Muslims, then they donate more to those countries, to Arab countries, right?
Exactly. And so we can shed light a little bit on the mechanisms there, both with these effects on attitudes and political preferences, but also we fielded a large-scale survey. And so in this survey, we asked people, you know, how much contact have you had with Arab Muslims? And in particular, do you have Arab Muslim friends? Do you have Arab Muslim neighbors or workplace acquaintances? And then we also asked about knowledge of Arab Muslims or Islam in general. So for example, we asked them to select some of the pillars of Islam. We asked them to define Ramadan. And what we find is that in counties that have larger Arab Muslim populations, people are more likely to have Arab Muslim neighbors. They're more likely to have Arab Muslim workplace acquaintances. And then most interestingly, they also know more about Arab Muslims and about Islam in general. So they're more likely to know what Ramadan is. They're less likely to say that the oppression of women or the subjugation of women and children to men are fundamental tenets of Islam. And in general, they have both more accurate and more positive beliefs about Islam and Arab Muslims. And so this seems to be one potential driver of these effects, is that people are not only interacting more, personally interacting more with Arab Muslims, but they're also learning more about Islam and reducing these negative stereotypes portrayed by the media and, you know, political entrepreneurs.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And so finally, in your paper, you go beyond Arab Muslims in your analysis and you show that exposure to any given foreign ancestry leads to more altruistic behavior toward that group. So how did you arrive at these results? And why do you think people tend to be more generous towards a certain group if they have had exposure to its members?
Exactly. So I think we view the Arab Muslim analysis as a useful case study because it gives us a lot of great outcomes to kind of trace out this causal chain from, you know, first immigrants arriving in a given area, interacting with them, learning more about that group, these effects on attitudes and political preferences, and then all of those translating into this revealed preference measure of generosity, which is donations. Now, you know, if we want to generalize and look at the effects of exposure to people from any given country, you know, of course, we're not going to have that same very, very rich set of outcomes. You know, I don't know, you know, people's attitudes toward Mongolians or to Sudanese or to Uruguayans, because those data sets in that rich form just don't exist. But what we can do is use this data set on donations. And so what we see are for each county, I see, you know, the donation flows to different countries. And so what we can show is that counties that have had larger exposure to immigrants from a given country, say counties that have had larger exposure to Cuban immigrants, are more generous toward Cuba in that they donate more. And again, these effects are driven by people who are not themselves of Cuban ancestry. So it seems to be driven by the white natives. And so one advantage when we go to the setting, at the risk of getting a little too technical, one advantage when we go to the setting is that because we have donation flows from many different counties to many different countries, we can include county fixed effects. And so what this is doing is controlling for any unobserved variation in counties. So you might say, oh, you know, I think this particular county was just always more generous toward immigrants. And so of course you're going to see greater donation flows, but it's not really reflecting a true causal effect of exposure on donations. But when we go to the setting where we have many different countries and many different counties, we can include these county fixed effects. And so what this is saying is that, you know, take away the average level of generosity for these counties. What these results show is that exposure to Cubans specifically raises donations toward Cuba, irrespective of their effects on donations toward other countries. Whereas, say, other counties that have had exposure to Mexicans specifically have more donations to Mexicans. And so I think this really makes the identification of these causal effects much stronger when we can go to this generalized setting. But then it also, as I say, lets us show that these effects are not unique to Arab Muslims, right? It's not just that, you know, Arab Muslims are the strange population where, you know, especially in the United States after 9/11, this has been a group that's very targeted, a lot of negative stereotypes in the media. You might say that exposure is really only working on them because of this very, very unique set of attributes. What we show is that that's not the case. It's that in general, exposure to a given group seems to raise generosity toward that group's ancestral country. And so that seems like you know, an important consideration when we think about, you know, how viable are societies that are diverse, right? You know, when we think about this growing hostility against minorities, it seems like important to keep in mind that over the long term, the effects of contact seem to be positive.
Yes, exactly. And so my next question is actually about the policy implications of your research and also about, you know, the importance of these diversity that you mentioned. And so what are the main lessons that policymakers can learn from your research? And maybe, you know, you can also comment on the fact maybe the government should have a say where the immigrants settle in the receiving country. Or do you think that would be a good idea? Or maybe not exactly. Not necessarily.
I think we want to be cautious in thinking about policy implications per se. You know, I think maybe the most direct set of policy implications that you might want to draw is thinking about, say, how to allocate refugees. You know, Europe is struggling with this, United States to a lesser extent. And I think it's tempting to draw some policy conclusions from this research. What I would say is that, you know, we're really focused on long-term effects here. And so, you know, it's not completely clear whether the short-term effects of exposure, how much those reflect the long-term, how much those go hand in hand. And so it could very much be that the short-term effects of exposure toward a given group are negative, right? You see, say that people are taking jobs or, you know, competing for scarce resources, and that leads to negative short-term effects, even if over the period of decades with cooperation, you know, those effects turn positive. And so we don't want to read too much into these results as it relates to policy conclusions. You might also think that, you know, are the effects of exposure linear? In the sense that if my goal is to reduce prejudice in general, is it better to put all of the Arab Muslims in one county, right? A really, really strong effect, or is it better to spread them out across the whole country? And our research can't really speak to that, right? We don't really know if, you know, having a really large group is going to reduce prejudice much more effectively than having that group spread out. And so I think we want to be cautious about drawing policy implications. But what I think it does speak to in a general sense is whether societies that are diverse, whether societies that have a lot of different groups, often that are coming in with some preconceived notions of hostility, whether these over a period of decade are viable.
Yes, exactly. And so you mentioned the European Union. That's also what I wanted to discuss with you, because indeed in the European Union, we have had the influx of Syrian refugees, especially in the last couple of years. And that led in many cases to protests of local population against accepting the refugees, and also an increase of hate speech against Arab Muslims on social media especially. And so do you think there is any way that the policymakers can use the results of your research to make sure this doesn't happen in the future, or at least if it does happen, how the heat of the debate can be reduced?
So I think this is going a little bit beyond our research in the sense that, you know, we're interested in the long-term effects, and these are really short-term effects over the period of a few years. But I think there is, you know, a growing literature that speaks to this. And so, you know, there are a couple of great papers that look at the effects of contact between different groups, even in the short term. And a growing theme seems to be that when you're able to get groups working towards the same goal, engaging in what you might call collaborative contact, that's much more effective. And so, you know, when immigrants are framed as, you know, stealing scarce jobs or competing for scarce resources, of course, that's going to have a negative effect. But when you think about if there's a way to get these groups working together, if there are, say, you know, government programs that can hire both both refugees and native people and get them working together towards the same tasks, then that seems, based on, you know, this previous work, that that's a much more effective way to reduce hostility and reduce prejudice when you can get people working toward the same goals. And so I think our paper isn't really able to speak with that because we're interested in these effects over the period of decades, kind of summing up over all of these types of different contact, collaborative contact, adversarial contact, and saying kind of what is the aggregate effect. But it seems, just based on this other work, that collaborative contact in the short run might have positive effects.
That's very interesting. And thank you, Akash, for this discussion. And I hope one day we do have these collaborative societies and diverse societies that don't, you know, have hate towards one group or the other. So thank you very much again for being on this podcast. And I wish good luck in your research.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.